outside looking like a slave home. Ain't got money for the cell phone. Hello? Wanna steal front for the video. Man. Can't you hear him knocking? Open up, let him in. I turn on the radio. I hear
no flex zone.
No flex zone.
No flex zone.
They know better.
They know better.
They know better.
They know better.
No flex zone.
No flex zone.
No flex zone.
No flex zone.
They know better.
They know better.
They know.
They know
better. Wanna go better.
No flexing.
And a gold bezel.
Flexing.
Treat a soul special. Treat a soul. Special, no flex zone, no flex zone. They know better, they know better. Oh no.
Blue railroad train, and going down the railroad. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line.
Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial. And
Dave on the board on July the 12th, 2015. Seems about right.
Yes. Part of our mission is to say something about people who have made a significant contribution to the community. And I didn't realize, but Jack Swing had passed. He was an architect. He was head of the Department of Architecture. When he retired, he retired to Monticello and bought a significant number of buildings just off the square. And he's spent some years remodeling there. His wife, Helene, has a brown bag restaurant there, which is very popular, and often people visit it on the way to Ellerton Park. He has two daughters, Christine and Barbara, and I ran into them because we were outside with vehicle display for the parade, and they one of the Spencer friends and Christine were went to school together, and they were just visiting, and I gave them a flashlight field trip around the little prairie, and in the process I realized that Jack had passed. He was an army person, very interested in planes, continued to be interested, and he and Helene are very supportive of arts, whether it be at Alton Park or Monticello or the like of WILL. So I would communing with Jack every once in a while. I was trying to save the Pepsin factory, and he was interested in that. He was a little in conflict with the city zoning ordinances because he had a background in that sort of thing and wanted to do his buildings up. And so that was sometimes a little conflict. But all in all, we're very glad to have had Jack Swing, and we'll miss him. I used to sit and talk at in the brown bag, and so there's fond memories there. Today I want to go repeat some of the discussion we had last week. It deserves to be revised. We were talking about the co-op and its location in a second building in Champaign, and the local planning around that. We have excellent planners in the city, and they get involved and actually are leaders in this process. But it's interesting that often local citizens and groups of citizens contribute to the understanding of a site and often initiate an event that gets formalized in city planning details. What we were talking about was the proximity to older buildings, older railroading, new railroading in that general area. We're also fairly close to the African American community, and as development moves north and includes the Bristol area north of Bradley Avenue, we need to think about what we might be able to do. I was suggesting that at least some of the area could be vegetable gardens, as in the past 50 years ago when that general area was heavily used for vegetable gardens. So the new technology that we're looking at is hump yards versus intermodal trains. It used to be and continues to be with heavy freight like grain and coal and gravel. There are things that come together in unit trains. A unit train, probably 100 cars long, but it can be broken in yards that have, like our owner yards, that have at least 10 tracks, and you can hump is the term used to put trains together. Some yards have a little hump where you push the train up the hill and let it run down into the yards. And various trains are assembled and they go in different directions, perhaps. But that has somewhat been replaced by intermodal trains, where the train does not come apart but is loaded just as you would load a semi-trailer. And that sort of technology allows for a more gentle type of railroading. You can lift that shipping crate onto an intermodal train and lift it off at its destination. You can go to a hub. The hubs are about 300 miles apart. In our situation, Chicago has hubs, and our nearest is Memphis. So then the assembly yards at Champaign become a through traffic, one train passing another, and some assembly, but not a lot, as in the past. So you can have industries that are smaller. It's fairly common in the East Coast and the West Coast, where the populations are more dense. But in the Midwest, the populations are fairly sparse, so there's not that community of intermodal industries that would need one, two, three shipping crates to be lifted onto a train. So the co-op is very near to this sort of train situation. And it may be that at least some of the existing buildings which were lined up for railroad use and still have railroad tracks in place in some cases. But you see the Black Dog Saloon has occupied the old railroad station. There are the 1923 railroad station is heavily occupied, and now the co-op is going up near to the Times Center and to Packer and to Mylander, who's taken over the old Illinois Power Distribution Center, and there were railroads into that. We also need to look at our history. We have a railroading history. We have a tradition. We have existing users. So one of those uses is the possibility of bringing recreational or historic trains into Champaign from the Railroad Museum in Monticello. And that sort of thing is not going to happen quickly, but there's an abandonment on the west side of Champaign, which is outside the jurisdiction of Champaign, but it would be key in maintaining a connection between Champaign and Monticello. It might be that doesn't happen for 50 years, but if you don't acquire that right away, right now, then that disappears forever. Some of us who are biologists will want the prairie soil on either side of that of the ballast. It's original prairie soil. Some places it's been dug up, but still it gives us access to a rapidly being lost ecosystem. So that 3 miles is between Bonneville and Seymour, and Heartland Pathways own another 4 miles, which could be, it was it has been abandoned but could be re-railed, and that would give a connection. So then you have to think of how that sort of train could come into Champaign, where it could park, how it could park. It might also be that the old platform that's there and the old water tower could be resuscitated, perhaps not as real, but as a symbol, an icon. And these buildings are within a few hundred yards of the new co-op situation. So I got out and walked around again to see where you might be able to put a garden, where you might be able to bring a train in, how might it get across the railroad to the major north-south railroad, which is Canadian National, to Urbana. It might even be that sometime we can put an interurban in between Urbana and with the west side of Champaign. We also know that this is in the vicinity of the African-American community and the Latino community sometimes. And we have to think where those people go to school, where they can be involved in industry. Are there jobs that might mesh with intermodal transportation? We wonder about the University of Illinois, which has a very respected railroad engineering unit that does a lot of research, and sometimes it is that short lines that are not used very much can be used for experimentation. How do we think about computerization? Some of our railroads are functioning because of fiber optics and huge computer facilities that can be very helpful. One of the difficulties is that railroads are not always on maps. They're not always understood by the public. The public sees them. The public is worried by them if they have to be held up by trains blocking the like of Bradley Avenue. So we have to think about how all these features come together. But one of the things is to help people understand what the technology is. It's rather helpful if you can understand that an interurban train, an intermodal train, has its wheels between the carriages rather than underneath them. You can break the intermodal train into units, perhaps seven or more units that could be shuttled off to a small industry, not necessarily demanding 100 cars or 50 cars, as is often the case with grain. And that's why the abandonment to the west is being considered. We would like to, for jurisdictions that are in Champaign and Urbana, to be aware that this abandonment, which is outside of their jurisdiction, may have an effect on what they can do in the next 10, 20, 15 years. So we've been working with the Rail Banking Act, and we asked if we could manage to put an interim trail on that 3 miles. In order to do that, we have to have the cooperation of the abandoning railroad, which in this case is Canadian National, and as of yet they have not agreed to do that. So the alternative is that those grain companies would be able to buy that 3 miles so that we could rerail 4 miles and get historic trains into Champaign. When you do that, you need features along the corridor because that railroad has to go and then come back. It cannot be a railroad that's delivering people. It's one that is a historic train, and you have to go to Monticello, go to Champaign, go and come back. That's a difference. That's the way historic railroads are handled. They are not serving people. But in the future, they might be able to serve people. The surface transportation just this last week has agreed to give top flight grain and premier grain to big grain companies that own perhaps 15 elevators each to think about shipping out by rail, which is a conservation of energy. It's less energy involved in moving 50 cars of grain than to ship that grain out by road vehicles that are doing 2, 3, 4, 5 miles to the gallon. So at the moment, we want people to know that that facility is there, that people are the companies and people involved are being given the opportunity to buy that bed. They're given time to do that, but we need to be able to understand the historic elements of things that might go with it. We need to understand that intermodal transportation may let people do small industrial things that they mightn't have been able to do before. We need to see how that balances with people movers or passenger trains. Freight trains are tremendously valuable. They're carrying millions of dollars worth of freight, and they move fast. They need to move fast. They don't like to stop, because if you stop a train of that dimension and you're going to start it again, you're going to take a lot of energy to move it. The people movers are not financial. They're getting to be some in some corridors, like in the east. But basically, people movers are heavily subsidized. So knowing a little bit about your railroads and how they come into Champaign without necessarily crossing a major line, so they don't have to have a pilot to pilot the train across a major intersection. We need to know how we might be able to come from Urbana to Champaign and further. So that's what we were talking about last week. And I was taking things to the idea store, and an intermodal train went by. So I moved, took a camera and moved up to the assembly yards to see if I could get a good explanatory photograph of an intermodal train. Very interesting. I stood there for quite a while. Trains were moving back and forth, and it was obvious that the railroads are doing things. There are a number of existing warehouses and the like there that used to have rail access until it was more convenient and to use semi-trailers. But things are changing, and the energy utilization and sustainability would suggest that we might be able to reuse some of those short lines. Anyway, I took photographs, and I wanted to say that we, as the public, have often done interesting things, and one of them locally is a rail trail from Urbana to Danville. It's part of a rail banking act. The railroaders looked around and saw that the bicycle people were using the abandoned railroads, and they offered them money and bridge preservation and tidal quieting. The locals would still have to pay the line, but the feds would make sure that the trail was developed. And the quid pro quo for the feds is that they have the right to come back in. So if you're looking at Chicago, St. Louis, Bloomington is in the middle, and that connects to Indianapolis. So there is the possibility that that rail could go back. But the railroads, I don't think, and the public is not ready for that sort of thing yet. So that's why the interim trail use agreement with Surface Transportation, which is a federal body that controls this and it implements the Rail Banking Act. It can change if politicians get involved and want to put in a factory between Urbana and Danville. It might well be that they'll exercise the right to re-rail the bed. That worries bicycle people and hikers, but it's the name of the game. That's where they've got a lot of their money to do this trail, and the whole purpose of it is to of the whole purpose of the Rail Banking Act is to save rights of way which we couldn't otherwise save. Well, I have been looking for a small group of people that might be interested in thinking about these sorts of things. So I sent an email to Cope Compton, who is an activist in many ways. But she was in New York and working with her daughter, Sarah. They're renovating a warehouse on the Hudson River. And that reminded me that community action can actually be very successful. Pete Seegers was rather disgusted by the pollution of the Hudson River. So he bought and reconstituted a yacht of considerable size that could support a number of bands and musicians, and they moved up and down the Hudson River, stopping at community resources that were not totally aware of the pollution of the river. They would also stop at the industries that were polluting. And in the long run, this resulted in the cleaning up of the Hudson. And so fish are now back in the Hudson, where they weren't before. Just across the way on Long Island, we had a family close out one of the last livestock farms near Oyster Bay, and that went to development. But the question was, there was a huge barn. Could that be relocated and functionally removed? So I got involved in this and suggested that there might be an agricultural or historical farm somewhere. And sure enough, there was a Long Island Antiquities to the north end of the island, which is more remote from New York City itself. They were asked if they might be able to use this building, and they were pleased because the barn that they used had burned recently, and they would be overjoyed to have this barn. The next question is how to move it. Well, the barn movers of Vermont were contacted, and I talked to them. They usually take barns down and take them to places like Colorado to establish a ski lodge. So they never go so far south as New York, but they thought this was interesting and flew down to New York and eventually took the barn apart, took it back to Vermont, and took the beams apart to make sure that the timbers that were rotten were removed and replaced, and they put in a mezzanine so people could go up to the hayloft, and brought the building back down and established it at Long Island Antiquities. I've never seen the barn, but it had a lot to do with its movement. But it's very much an example of how community people can get together and do interesting things.
It's half past. This might be a really good time to jump in while Dave is looking for his next notes to speak about. And this is the Prairie Monk on WEFT. Today's July the 12th, 2015, and Dave has been talking about intermodal railways and Champaign-Urbana and what that could mean for the future. You mentioned in your notes here that there actually are places where rail beds were turned into trails, and then the railroad said, you know what, we can actually make use of that again. So it actually has already happened where some of the trails have gone back into rails.
Yes, that is very interesting because New York has done that with a high rail. And it's been so popular that Chicago has taken a hint from that, I'm sure. They have a high rail that hasn't been used for some time, and they're reconstituting it as a high rail. That's another example of things that local people can do, and often it rolls over to the local jurisdiction getting involved and actually being tremendously helpful and actually being essential, because some of this sort of stuff is beyond the capacity of small groups to do things. Went to Villa Grove this week. Villa Grove Methodist Church has been interested in a little intersection of roads that cross the railroad line. It's very busy, so the intersections have been closed, leaving a little triangle that can be a prairie. And Jim Fay and a bunch of others have gotten together and transplanted prairie into here. And I wanted to support this, so I went down to Villa Grove and found the workshop that was on the morning had been completed. But the gentleman who was mowing around it was making a statement, because if you have a prairie, for some people it looks like weeds, and you have to make sure that you make a statement and make it look like it exists for a purpose. Might be you even have to put up a fence, not only for to preserve the prairie from the public, but to preserve the prairie from deer and the like. There were plants, including monada, which is blooming at the present time, yellow coneflower, prairie drop seed, phlox, uh, Black Eyed Susan, and a range of prairie species, including obedient plant and clover, and a general atmosphere that is supported by the church. The railroad line, which is a very busy line, goes adjacent to this plot. And there's an elevator line which used to go from Villa Grove. It was Missouri Pacific, and it went through Longview, Broadlands, Allerton, Sidell, Indianola, to Danville on the bottomlands. Westville first, and then on the bottomlands to Danville. That line came out. Some of it is a small spur is still there. So it is almost essential for those sorts of spurs to be used for the parking of maintenance vehicles and the like. So there were maintenance vehicles there, and some of them were loaded with railroad ties with the rails on them so that a section could be put into the main line very quickly without blocking traffic for a long time. So there were perhaps five cars with rails already prefabricated to go into place. There was a airplane there, and it was constantly dusting the corn crop nearby, or I didn't see which crop it was, whether it was soybeans or corn. But it was almost raining, and if you put herbicide or what have you, insecticide, onto plants when it's going to rain, a lot of it's going to run off, and eventually some people are going to drink that. So I had to think about that as I was waddling around Villa Grove. I came back by Jesse Cemetery. Jesse Cemetery was a wonderful little cemetery because it was what we refer to as a dead cemetery. It is absolutely loaded with prairie plants. And to my great disgust, the whole area has been mown. I could find a little Ruellia plant in the lawn. I could find a clump of dock. Dock has such a deep root that it could stay. The cemetery gravestones were there. Sometimes mowing can destroy those gravestones because they hit them from the side. And right across the way was a bunch of Canadian thistle, which is a noxious weed, and it was very nicely fluffy at this time. And I can imagine that mowing that was being done on the cemetery would have a counterpart, would distribute that weed all over the place. We need reform for mowing. The more I encounter it, the more I get disappointed by it. I was also pleased with some people who mowed down to the ditch and let the roadsides grow. There are a number of people who do that. They mow out alongside their homestead, but leave the roads alone. They were also remarkably clean of dumped material, and that I applaud. Every once in a while there's a pop bottle or something like that, but basically very nice. At Jesse, there is a plot of land that was cemetery at one stage, and the gravestones were moved to the edge, and they still exist on the roadside side of the cemetery. But corn has been planted there, and it has been planted for many years. So we have to wonder about who does what with what and what heritage. You have to know that in Europe you don't have place for graves, and often you come back in 20 years, your grave is gone and somebody else is there. So we do have some questions about graves, and for a long time people didn't be cremated, but that is a different alternative, and you can also have your body used for research. That's another alternative altogether. But to see a cemetery taken over for crops means a little bit of misunderstanding. For the cemetery to be mown like that when it was such a nice place for prairie is sad. I waddled around. The area is on the Ombra, and there's all sorts of little streams that run into the Ombra, and they're hard to deal with, and they're very wet. And so I stopped, and I drove along bendy roads that are there that way because you have to get across the swampland. But I came back by the Yankee Ridge Moraine, and there were plots that you could see the front slope of the moraine and the road going down it, and you could be on the high point. I also passed railroad lines, which you can see going up the hill. So you get this distant idea of a morainic landscape, a glaciation. You can also, in some places, get high enough to look over the cornfields, and at the moment they're tasseling, and so the green that you saw 2 weeks ago is now a sort of yellowy tassel. Somebody asked me this week, should they remove their tassels? They have been so attuned to people doing genetic corn increase where they take the tassel off so that the silks on the cobs can be not self-pollinated, but pollinated by a different male population. That's for genetic increase. It's not necessary if you have a plot of corn in your backyard to take off the male element and to prevent self-pollination. So I looked at that. I came past the Plotner farm, and the Plotner house is still there. So there's cultural details. It might be an old elevator, it might be an old building or an old barn, but often people keep those elements because they are a part of the history. Let me look at my notes again. I think what I wanted to say was there are just gobs of these examples of people doing interesting things, and some of them that I would list locally is the like of the Virginia Theater becoming a place where the Ebert Festival is, the Art Theater. The co-op itself was established in the Vietnam era when people felt they would like to have an alternate way of working with cars. There was a garage, there was a co-op garage, a number of co-op things. Some involved legal battles. So those things are still around. So what we're doing is trying to bring people together to look at landscape, look at their cultural landscape, look at their industry, and see what they could leave with flexibility for the years to come. You have to know that the next generation is going to be very different from our generation. You have to know that the young folk that are coming up now will have less natural area to work with, and less as population grows. You have to know that there are fewer jobs because the jobs are often taken over by manufacturing robots, and we still need human involvement, but we need the involvement of people who have a lot of intellectual capacity and have degrees and mathematics and understanding that is beyond some of the general population. So how do we bring these things together and at least think about them and work into the future in such a way that they're flexible? You have to know that railroads have been around perhaps for 200 years now, and they haven't changed an awful lot. And roads haven't changed a lot. They parallel the railroads often. So there are elements of towns and locations and geological hills or mountains or swamps that were part of a long-term involvement. So people also are taking less time to the technologies of living and having a family are such that there's more time available for a little bit of tourism, a little bit of finding out about yourself, your population of friends and relatives. So the atmosphere has changed, and it will change for your grandchildren and their grandchildren. So you can't put down things that are too heavy. The railroads might be fairly heavy, because once you put a railroad down, you're going to stay there. But we need to do the things around those elements with the knowledge that change will occur. To some extent, that means that we need the help of young people who might be able to think beyond their ages of maturity. More and more, we're finding that our brains don't stop developing. We find that young people up to the age of 25 are still developing. And so we can't impose a lot of wisdom on people who are finding themselves and developing accordingly. I'm trying to think. Yes, let me have a look here. Yes, water. I mentioned the Ombra, but I looked at some of the fields that were suffering from water loss. You have to know that the plants need oxygen to the roots, and if you have a little low spot, then the water accumulates and your plants are not going to grow. The corn plants at the moment are 12 feet high. They are substantial. They've been often bred so that they don't fall over. I didn't see any fields that had lodging. Lodging is a term used to when a crop falls down. And the agricultural industry has had to develop harvesters that have big reels on them that actually harvest large crops. I didn't see the need for that, but the growth is tall and strong, and I took photographs of the prop roots that are on the bottom that help to support the plant. It, being a tall plant doesn't necessarily mean that it yields well, but you can have a short plant that yields better than a tall plant. It's a lot. It depends on the variety. At the moment, the tassel is there, and the silks are out, and two or three cobs at just about the right height to harvest, and it's so dense that you can't even walk in to such a field. If you watch carefully, you'll see some of the plants have the bottom leaves that are sort of brown, and that means that the yield there is going to be down a little bit because there's been too much water there. If you get to a really low spot, then the corn plants are only 2 feet high, and you know that there's not going to be any yield there. If you look at the soybeans, you will have the same sort of thing. There'll be dead soybeans where the water is, and there'll be reduced yield in nearby places. So one of the things that you have to know about this area is that outwash plains especially have had to be drained. So all those fields are drained with herringbone drains. There used to be ceramic, but now are usually plastic with drain holes in them. And the water can move off to open drains, which are quite big drains sometimes. So I took photographs of those drains, and I took photographs of grass waterways that allow the water to move without eroding and taking excess nitrogen and phosphate down into the waters of the Mississippi and out into the Gulf to cause a dead zone. The agriculturalists have got pretty smart. They do a lot of research. Their original researchers that suggested that Illinois especially should have soil mapping. So that soil mapping has helped, because if you have a sandy soil, it has less ions that the crystallography is such that it won't retain as much of your fertilizer or of your herbicide or insecticide, and that will run off. So if you're working with a dusting machine, you can make sure that you don't put on excess chemicals. If you have a very deep loam drummer or a Flanagan soil, then the clay that exists there is more able to retain the fertilizer, so you could apply at a different rate. To some extent, we're treating soil as a petri dish where you add nitrogen and phosphate, and so it's doing more than just use our very fertile soils in the first place. So that's where you run into groups of people who are doing organic farming that don't always depend upon a lot of artificial fertilizer that has to be produced somewhere in industry and shipped in, and that can be costly. Sometimes I look at the soil, and the soil is barren. There are no earthworms. And I suspect that if I did a chemical analysis, this wouldn't be your native soil that you pick up in your hands and has a certain amount of organic matter. And so we have to think about that. I'm very pleased sometimes to see a crop growing a few weeds, because that means that they haven't been over-herbicided. And I wonder as I go by churchyards and I think about one generation moving on to the next, how we have an extension service and how we teach our younger generations how to use the territory. We have some wild ones who leave little tire marks in the road. So I sometimes photograph the tire marks, because that says something about growing up and learning about how to work with the landscape. And will that person who is revving up the car and moving it at such a pace that it sort of buries into the asphalt, is that young person going to be on a huge tractor, and is he going to mow, or is he going to herbicide, and how do we think about that? We have remarkable people that do all these things, but every once in a while we have a question or two, and that's quite legitimate. Well, I think we're nearly time, and I enjoy talking to you, and hope that you will go visit something, whether it's a reindeer farm or an art show. There's been things in Champaign last night that people were enjoying, and we have to wonder how they fit into the railroad system and the food system and the bar system and the traffic system. And that's what we're begging you to do. So this has been Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. And as always, the views expressed here on the Prairie Monk program are solely those of the speakers and nobody else. Yes, hopefully a few folks were out here last evening. I was actually on the air through all of the time when the big bands were supposed to be here, but it sounds like they all got rained out. There were no Toad the Wet Sprocket and Smash Mouth, I understand, both had to cancel. They weren't allowed to perform because it was so wet out there. But if you were here earlier than that, you got to hear Brandon T. Washington and Larry Gates as Curb Service playing. Uh-huh. So, and keep your ears open. There'll be more chances like that to get out and hear music live in Champaign and Urbana as we move into the summer. Dave, you keep saying that this is the time of year when we have drought. I've gotten rained out of 4 softball games out of 12 I'm supposed to have played. I keep waiting for that drought to set in. I would actually love to see those drought conditions. And I'm sure people who want to go hear these live concerts wouldn't mind either if we wouldn't get rain on all of our music festivals as well. So it is just 1 minute till noon. Stay tuned for Shruti coming up next here on WEFT Champaign. We are community radio for East Central Illinois.